Welcome to Zavi's Video Rewind, a podcast from Zavi, the home of pop culture. I'm your host, Emily Murray, and together we'll be digging into our video archives, discussing a wide range of cult classics, all of which have recently received or will be receiving a new release on disc. Each week I'll be joined by a guest to discuss a movie and the importance of film restoration. And for this episode, we'll be diving into the extraordinary 2014 horror, The Babadook, director Jennifer Kent's feature debut. The film has recently arrived in 4K, courtesy of a new limited edition release from the good folks over at Second Sight, which comes complete with new artwork, a hardback book filled with essays, and a selection of art cards. The story follows a young single mother and her child as they fall into a deep well of paranoia when an eerie children's book titled Mr. Babadook manifests in their home. Horror writer and academic Mary Beth McAndrews joins me to discuss this astonishing horror. How's it going?
It's great. How are you?
I'm okay. I always feel really awkward introducing podcast guests. I'm like, I do this formal intro and then I'm like, hello. We are talking about such a good film today.
Seriously.
This is such a good film. Do you remember when was the first time you saw it? Because I don't think I actually saw it in the cinema. I think my boyfriend showed it me like later on. And I was gutted I've not seen it on the big screen yet.
I know. I didn't see it in theaters either. I think it was when it came on Netflix. And that's when I actually first heard about it, because I don't think it had come out in theaters around me. So I watched it on Netflix with my fiance and blown away. It was, I think, one of the first movies that launched that whole elevated horror discussion, which is a whole thing. But it was one of those first movies, I think, that really tackled like a new version of tackling grief and monstrous motherhood. Like, it feels like that really started a trend in horror. And it's just so well done, and it's directed by a woman, and is just so different from what we had been seeing previously. So it is just like such an influential recent horror film, I think.
Yeah. I want to talk a bit about the elevated horror thing, because I think like this is a term that's used a lot. It's thrown around a lot in terms of a genre recently. And what do you think about that term? Because I hear some people think about it quite negatively, like we shouldn't really sort of label this as like elevated, as if it's better than your sort of standard jump scare films. Yeah. But, you know, I also think it kind of shows also that there's more under the surface, as you said earlier.
So I don't like the term personally. I think that it does create this weird divide in horror. And I think that label is given by a lot of non-genre people, a lot of critics who aren't necessarily that familiar with the genre. And it's like, oh, these are good horror movies versus like slashers or more teen-oriented horror. And I think that's bad. I think all horror has value. I mean, like, yeah, there are bad horror movies, but there's bad every movie. And, you know, there are horror movies that are a little bit deeper, a little bit more oriented towards a deeper political or like message rather than jump scares. But I think differentiating like that just creates a very unnecessary divide in what horror is. And horror has always been like this, though. I mean, like, with The Witch and The Babadook, there seemed to be like an increase in elevated horror. But like, there's always been movies that talk about grief and motherhood. Like, that's pretty common in horror. I just think that for a while it wasn't as mainstream. And it came back with The Babadook. Especially because like the 2000s were quite a year for horror. I love the 2000s, but like it's a weird year for horror. There's a lot of remakes and there's a lot of like iffy slashers. So it feels like with The Babadook and other films like that, it was like, oh, okay, this is like a new era of horror with the new decade.
Yeah. Yeah. And Jennifer Kent, like, this is her first like feature. How?
I just like, I swear, I like watch these movies and they're like, oh yeah, it's my first feature. I'm like, I hate you. Like, what in the heck? Like, you just like knock it out of the park your first try. Not your first, you know what I mean? Like, you just like burst onto the scene with this amazing film with amazing performances and just like super creative. And it's just, I think it also showcases like there's so many cool stories to tell in horror, and there's so many amazingly creative people out there, and that there's just so many cool stories left to tell, and horror can do such cool things. I love horror.
We all love horror. I think it was really interesting what you said about how motherhood, especially, has always been a theme throughout horror. But this is such a different way of tackling it. And we will obviously talk about grief because that's the main theme of the film. But I haven't seen The Babadook in a while, and I rewatched it last night, and I forgot how well it tackles maternal depression. And I think it's because it's always sort of been the grief movie. But actually, you know, this single mum, she is going through hell. And there's some great moments where, you know, Amelia's in the room with her sister and their friends, and they're sort of just saying how hard their lives are and stuff. And she just snaps at them. And she's like, God, you know, life must be so hard for you. Like, look at me. I'm literally like in hell right now. And I think we really see through Essie Davis's performance, like how much Amelia's struggling. And I think it's just such an interesting portrayal of maternal depression.
I agree. And I think a lot of the time in horror, mothers are either really maternal or they're evil. There isn't really a middle ground in horror a lot of the time. It is very black and white with moms. And there's always, you know, moms are usually monstrous because there's the whole like, oh, your mom is evil, you're affected. And there's this whole thing with like, your mom's supposed to be the one that raises you. And there's always this relationship with monstrous motherhood and horror. Like, Friday the 13th, there's a Mrs. Voorhees, there's the Brood. I mean, it's in everything. And so in this movie, I think there was a really marked shift in terms of showing motherhood as very complicated as it is. I'm not a mother myself, but like, it's a complex thing. And sometimes you like, you don't like your kid. I think that's just like a normal thing to like, you still love your kid, but they're annoying you. So like when she screams at her son, who is one of the most annoying children in horror cinema, you feel that. And like when she's, you know, going through all this depression and when she's, you know, doing things that seem bad, it makes sense though, because it's just like a manifestation of that depression, of being a mother and trying your best. But sometimes your best isn't good enough, or just sometimes you're exhausted. Like, it does a really good job portraying that exhaustion. And I think this carries over into movies like Hereditary that show motherhood. And like, yeah, she's not a perfect mother, but it doesn't necessarily mean she's a terrible mother either. And I think that's really important to show in movies in general now, that like motherhood isn't just you are a good mom or a bad mom. Like, you just have your good days and your bad days. So
there's a moment, you know, where she says to the kid that she wishes he died instead of her husband, and that just seems to come from such a raw place for me within her. And it feels real, like it is shocking. And she obviously says later on that she doesn't mean it, and it's when she's possessed by the Babadook. But in my mind, I don't know how you view it, but that seems to be coming from a deep, deep thought that she's harbored away in her mind. And that moment really strikes me as like, this is real.
Yeah, it's like those deep, dark thoughts that you never want to vocalize, but it's like the Babadook possessed her to vocalize those thoughts and confront them. And like, while that's obviously, you know, you never want to say that to your kid, I think it's important to acknowledge those feelings and not push them down. Again, I'm not a mother, so I'm not sure if that translates, but at the same time, it's like you have these feelings and you should address them. It's like a lot of the time you think, oh, I can't say anything bad about my kid, I can't have regrets, but then that breeds resentment, which I think is very obvious in this movie. There's a lot of resentment between her and her kid, which is also really cool to see, because there's always resentment between adult kids and their parents, but seeing resentment with a small child is sad and it's rough to see, but I also think it's a very accurate portrayal of like relationships with your parents, especially when they're kind of fraught and not the healthiest.
I think that's right. And I think Sam is such an interesting character, and as we said earlier, like, he is unbearable at points. Like, I literally hate him. I think he's like screaming in the car and I'm like, please shut up. And I think it's a really interesting decision to make him. I would say he's the right level of unbearable. He's not too much that I have a headache, but he's enough to add to the stress and intensity of the situation. And they couldn't have made him an angel, because A, that's not a horror kid. And B, I then don't think we'd have any sort of empathy for Amelia. I think he has to be badly behaved and going through something for us to feel her like struggle, I think.
Well, and also like, he's grieving too. And he has that really weird position of his dad died when they were on the way to the hospital. Like, that's a really weird position to be in as a kid. And, you know, kids process trauma differently. And I think he's just acting out in that way, which doesn't excuse it, but she's like screaming in the car, and then when he yells at her, "Do you want to die?" which always sticks out in my head, that moment, which is like, it's so intense, but at the same time, like, there is a sweet child like purity to him, of he just wants to protect his mom. Like, he really does love his mom, but he doesn't know how to process his feelings. You know, he has grown on me more as I have thought about the movie, but he is still very much like a very frustrating poor child.
Very frustrating, putting it lightly, I think. But yeah,
oh my God.
It's the screaming. It's the screaming that gets me, and the kicking in the car.
It's the kicking in the back of the seat. Like, having little brothers, always like, it's the worst thing in the world when you're just like, please leave me alone just for 2 seconds. Please be quiet.
Yeah. I must say, the other kids I don't think come across well. Like, the girl, I think is her sister's daughter. Like, she just seems really nasty. That is a nasty piece of work there.
Well, that's like, it's interesting to think about the two of them in comparison, because it's like, she's definitely spoiled and comes from a place of privilege, where he is kind of trying to cope with his own traumas and resentment. And it's very interesting in seeing both the sisters and this kid's like contrasted, and how they're like, oh, he's weird, he has feelings and tantrums, but it's like, he's like 8, you know, at the same time, like, you know, he's a little kid, and yeah, it's annoying, but you know, why are you treating him so differently? Those kids are cruel. Kids are really cruel. Like, kids are so mean.
For sure, they are. As you said earlier, you know, Sam is grieving as well, and it, you know, it comes out differently compared to his mother. His mother, I think, is obviously trying to suppress it. She won't mention her husband at all, whereas Sam, his grief just seems to roam around free in all the monsters he sees. And I think it's really interesting, the comparison between how Sam and Amelia are grieving, and how, you know, this is Jennifer showing us, like, people grieve in different ways.
100%. And I think, you know, this was one of those first instances, or like big instances, of seeing grief as a monster. And I think that really resonated with people, and how it was a monster for both of them, but they reacted differently. Like, Sam was ready to go to war. He had all of his toys and he was ready to fight it. And then she was much more resistant and much more susceptible to the influence, to this possession from the Babadook, and this kind of like giving herself over to it, because it's almost easier to give yourself over to it rather than acknowledging your grief. Which, I mean, in the grieving process, that's true. It feels easier just to let it consume you rather than fighting back against it. And it's almost like this movie, it's like the Babadook is the 7 stages, like all the stages of grief, and her going through them via possession, which is, I think, really fascinating. Especially at the end, when he's chained in the basement. Like, I think about that ending all the time, and how it isn't just like, it's gone, but how, you know, it never goes away. And it's difficult because you have to feed it. And that might not seem satisfactory to a lot of people, but it's the reality. Like, that monster doesn't always go away. And yeah, you can like quiet it and you can deal with it, and it's out of sight, out of mind sometimes, but you also can't forget it's there.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, like, if it was just on my second watch, but I found the ending a bit comforting in a way. I don't know if that's just me, but kind of comforting and kind of uplifting, that she does now have a handle on this grief, and she can sort of, because it, as you said, grief never goes away, it's always there, but it doesn't feel any more of it is hanging over you. And it kind of, I don't know, there's something sort of comforting about the sort of monster in the basement who you can just sort of feed every now and again. But yeah, I don't know what you think about that, but I do think there's something uplifting in the fact that it's still there, but in a kind of like, yeah, more comforted way, or sort of, it's a presence you can control now.
Oh, that's interesting. But like you know, it's, you know, the monster in the basement, you're not ready for it. But here, you know, it's there, you know where it is, and you're ready
prepared.
For it. Exactly. Yeah. So there, I see that. I never thought about it as comforting, but that is true. That is a good point. Like, you know, you don't want to face it, but you can, and you're prepared for it, and you know what to do, rather than being kind of hit out of nowhere with it.
Yeah.
Well, and again, it's comforting because it's honest. You know what I mean? Like, it's not trying to like sugarcoat that process, but really just acknowledging that it's difficult and it's hard, and it's just something that, you know, people go through. And I think that's really important in discussing grief, especially in horror.
I think you're right. I think the fact that you sort of always know it's there, rather than the way it sort of jumps on you, because the Babadook just springs on you. And I think that's the words in the book. I think it's like, you see him in your room at night and you won't sleep a wink. That's like how grief just suddenly springs in your mind, like by catching the sight of like a piece of clothing or maybe a picture, then it's sort of just there in your mind. What do you think about the portrayal of grief as this, well, it is a monster, but you know, this really interesting sort of black mass, like it feels so empty inside, I think.
I agree. And I also just like the construction of the monster, like what he looks like. Like he looks human, but not really. Like there's something uncanny about him with his pointy fingers, his creepy face. And it is like, there isn't a lot of, you don't see the full figure really very often. You hear him going Babadook and like have that creepy voice, but you don't really see his form very often. And I think that, again, is a really interesting like, illustrative piece of grief, is like it kind of sneaks up on you. You don't always see it right away. And then it kind of jumps out of nowhere. And I think this is one of the most effective ways I've seen grief as monstrosity, like as a monster really portrayed, because it isn't trying necessarily to be like jump scare, jump scare, jump scare, and like look at this creepy monster, but more relying on tension and dread, which... again, I think is a big thing in like the idea of elevated horror, that there's more dread. I will say there's nothing bad with a good jump scare, but I think that the way that the Babadook is created is really a good testament to like that kind of portrayal of grief as creature.
Yeah. And I agree. I think it is all about tension and dread, and the way that Jennifer Kent sort of just crafts, it is just so tense. It is intense. Like, this is not an easy going film. If people haven't seen it, it is not easy going.
And it's, like, not very long, but the whole time you're just, like, you just feel so tense and so uncomfortable the whole time, because it's just nonstop. It's relentless. Like, once it starts, it just keeps going, which I appreciate, though. Like, I think, you know, it is paced really well and knows exactly the kind of emotions it wants to invoke in every scene, which is amazing to see.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's only like 90 minutes long, so it is a really short film. And like as you said, the pacing's spot on, but also the way tension is built, like there are a couple of jump scares, but it sort of, it just draws fear out of you. There's something like lingering from the start. Like I love the starting shot, which is her falling onto the bed with the camera, because it's such an unusual, it just seems to me like a bit unusual, so I'm already on edge, like right from the very start. I just think also that house isn't right at all.
That house, oh my god, that house is like the creepiest house too, and it feels so like sterile except for the little kid's room. Like his room looks like a kid's room, but the rest of the house just feels like empty and stark and just like uncomfortable. Like nothing about it feels like home. It just has a horrific vibe. Like it's just like the hallway into the kitchen and the like, and the door to the basement, like absolutely not.
Yeah, it's like a sense of decay, or like it's like, or the life's been sucked out of something, or even maybe like an infection, like it's sort of been affected by this darkness. And I think the house goes really well the way that she shot it. Like it's so grey to look at. Again, it's so, like there's no colour at all. Which I thought was interesting, because even just the whole grey nature of it, it made me feel cold inside.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe the movie, cold. It just feels, it's like deeply emotional, but also really cold, because everyone is so cold to one another. There's no empathy, it feels like, from anyone, and it just feels like everyone is very separate and wants to live in their own separate bubbles, even though they're all family. Yeah. And it just is, and Essie Davis is really good at portraying that coldness, but like, in a relatable way, if that makes sense, because sometimes that frigidity kind of comes off as like, oh, this is annoying, but she does it so well that it's like, I get it. And she gives a nuance to that frigidness that you really understand. Like you get why she's acting cold towards the guy she works with. You get why she's acting cold towards her son. Like it feels very justified and very well created.
Yeah, I agree. She's fantastic. And I just feel tired looking at her face.
It's like the bags under her eyes and like her, I'm like, I get it. Like, I understand. Like, she looks like a mother, like just a tired mother who's trying her best to work and make money and pay for everything. And she just is like over it.
I think Essie's great. And we haven't really spoke about Noah yet, because his performance, I think, kind of gets a bit overshadowed by Essie's. But I think he's also good at playing this, as we said, sort of unbearable child. But I kind of like him by the end, and I like him more with each watch. I think once I've got over the screaming, because that again is a lot of screaming. But yeah, I think he's great.
He is great. And like, I'm always so impressed by child actors. Like, how do you do that? Like, you take direction so well and you're able to make me not like you. And I think that is huge. Like, that kid was able to elicit such a strong emotional reaction from the audience. Like, that in itself is a testament to what he's able to do. And like, it's just so impressive, like the way he screams, but the way he like kind of changes moods and like is loving, but then is intense and really does embody that kind of like the kid that you love so much and is going through a lot. And you just, it's hard to kind of get a read on his emotions, but you still love that kid. So it is really, he was so impressive. Like the two of them together are like so good. Cause it's just the two of them for most of the movie.
Yeah.
And they're just so good together.
They are so good together. Yeah. And I like the end. I like it when they're sort of celebrating his birthday. Obviously, like, the first time it's celebrating his actual day. Like, it's so... I mean, that's also why I said it's kind of uplifting and comforting at the end, because it's just... I love birthdays, to be honest. But it just seems like... It just seems really nice and wholesome. Even though, like, tragedy has struck, you know, they've been through hell. It's just nice that they come together on his birthday, I think.
Yeah, and there's more color to it because they're outside. So there's like a little bit more warmth. But then it also feels like they're on the same page because they both like get the worms and they go downstairs. And it feels like they together now understand each other's grief and can better support each other. And it feels like they are now a family unit rather than two disparate people living in the same house.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's what the film is all about, really, is just having... You know, they're grieving differently and they have to sort of come together as one.
Yeah.
To fight it. Not to fight it, I suppose, but to put a handle on it.
Confront it. Because that's the whole thing. It's like they don't fight it, but at the end she looks at it and is like, get out of my house. And like, that's what happens. Like, she screams at it and just owns it and like holds her kid so close and screams at it. And I love that because it's not some like bloody epic like knife showdown, but it's like a confrontation and acknowledgement, and that is what gets it to go away, or at least weakens it.
Yeah,
which I think again is like a really awesome way to portray grief as monstrosity, and how you can defeat that monstrosity with more than just weapons, but like just acknowledging it and like looking it in the face, and that being its weakness.
Yeah, it is a really, like, now that you say it and I'm thinking about it, it is a really different sort of end horror battle, I'm going to call it.
Yeah.
Because it's not a battle, it is, as you said, it's an acknowledgement of, right, we just have to live with you, but we'll live with you, like, by our turns, I suppose, rather than letting
exactly.
it sort of hang over you.
It's like getting more agency. It's like, you know, finally discovering how to have agency over your own brain. And again, illustrated through this top hat wearing weirdo. But like, you know, it's all about reclaiming agency, which is, I think there's a lot of movies that make it seem easy and make it seem like kind of like a very linear process. But this movie shows agency, emotional agency, as a process that is a roller coaster and doesn't ever stop, which again, I really appreciate, because there's more of an honesty to it than like a kind of trying to make a tightly wrapped narrative that all makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And it makes it more powerful too. It makes it more relatable, I think, and more real and raw. And you know, it's such a good film. it just is, okay.
It seriously is just so freaking good.
And it's what you said about the timing as well. Like, it really did just come out during this time of excellent horrors, which had, you know, like all these sort of themes going on. Like, I think I watched this in the same week I saw Under the Shadow, which is another one of my favorite horror films.
Oh yes,
so good.
Love Under the Shadow. It's so good. Yeah, like again, I think that year in particular, in like 2011, 2012, 2013 was a really pivotal shift in horror, and like what we're seeing more now, which is like, again, elevated horror, but like a kind of horror that's a little bit more willing to be emotionally vulnerable, I think is the way that I think about it, and is like willing to be a little bit more complex and nuanced. And that's horror in general now, though. I think people are finally giving themselves the space to more explicitly deal with these kinds of things. Like, I'm thinking about Relic from this year.
Natalie Erica James, that's so good.
Yeah, so good. And like in a similar vein of like really acknowledging these things and addressing them head on in a really beautiful, creepy, scary way. And understanding these things are scary, but giving them a little bit more complexity rather than just like scary monster must defeat it.
Yeah. I mean, horror has always been a great way of like looking at trauma and looking at themes such as grief and stuff. And they just seem to be a match made in heaven because it's just because it's a fear, I think, and it's the way that it brings it out and it brings out the dread, as you sort of said earlier, you know, this sort of the Babadook, like it's a grief as a monster. It's just a really good way of processing it.
Exactly, but it also in a way feels very validating that people see that grief as a monster or like depression as this monster. And I think seeing that on screen feels very validating that like this isn't just me being sad, like there is a there is something that is more than just my brain, but like seeing it as a monster and seeing it illustrated in such a way I think is super validating. And I think that's why people love horror, because there is a lot of, I think horror is a lot of validation of your feelings and kind of puts those feelings on screen and is a safe space for you to process those feelings and trauma as well. I think horror is so cathartic. And I think it's a really, for a lot of people, including myself, it's just like a really great way to deal with your traumas and your healing process. And the Babadook is no exception to that.
It's not at all. You know, so as you mentioned earlier, this podcast is all about sort of new releases and Second Sight, who they're so great at re-releases. Like I think I sort of mentioned Under the Shadow earlier, I got that version last year and so good. So they recently released a new gorgeous 4K. The artwork is stunning on this release, you know,
so pretty.
Which comes complete with art cards and hardback books. And, you know, as this podcast is all about sort of looking at the importance of sort of remasters and restorations and re-releases, because it is something that we see every year now, and they are becoming sort of increasingly popular. Like there's so much attention on this Babadook one, A, because it's a great film, and B, it's a celebration of it as well.
Yeah.
So I sort of wanted to know, why do you think it's important for films like the Babadook to receive these new releases? You know, I think it's like, it's been 7 years now since it first came out.
Well, I think in general, there's this really big emphasis on physical media now, which I love and also hate because all of my shelves are full of Blu-rays, these like amazing re-releases and imports. I'm just like, well, I have to have it.
Yeah.
Because these films are so good and you don't want them to be lost to time. There's so many movies that have been lost to just like decay of film, of like physical film. And, you know, I feel like there's a proactivity to like the Second Sight releases of bringing these movies, preserving them, but also bringing them back into the zeitgeist. So like they bring these movies back into the into people's minds because of how important they are. And I think that's a huge part of it. But it also just validates how amazing these films are and the importance they have in the horror genre and the canon. And it just feels like, how am I going to describe it? Sometimes the movies come out, they're released, and then they go into the ether, and then you never really talk about them again. So these re-releases are a celebration. And I think a lot of the time you think of restoration and re-releases for movies from like the 70s, the 60s, the 80s, like old releases. But I think this proactivity, like I said, of, you know, more recent films shows that, you know, this is horror history. And it 7 years, I can't believe it was 7 years ago. But just really wanting to now honor what horror looks like now and what that history looks like. Because I think so often people think of horror history as like 80s, but you know, the 2000s were 21 years ago. And so that is a lot of horror history that needs to be preserved and needs to be respected and needs to be appreciated.
Yeah. And as you touched upon earlier, you know, the Babadook was part of that sort of era, which was sort of a revival in this genre. Like, it makes sense to me that films like this are getting re-releases now, because I imagine there's a lot of people who maybe like Hereditary, you know, like Relic, and they might have not watched the Babadook yet. And I don't think you'd have those films without the Babadook either.
Exactly.
And they might have not been as widely seen. And I think, you know, by having films like the Babadook re-released now, people who probably like Hereditary and stuff will be like, oh, actually, I haven't seen that. This looks like a really nice release. Let's pick it up and give it a go. So it brings new audiences too, I think.
Exactly. And like you said, I think it really reinforces that canon of really important movies. Like Second Sight, you know, did Revenge, which is one of my favorite movies. And they're doing Lake Mungo, which is like a super influential found footage movie that doesn't have a release. So it's like these movies are getting the recognition they deserve as being part of the horror canon. It's not just Nightmare on Elm Street. It's not just Friday the 13th. But like these are films that are shaping what horror looks like now. And like they are speaking to the future of the genre.
Yeah. And a good thing about Second Sight, you know, I love the extras that come with it. I don't know if it's just because I'm like a bit of a, like a nerd and I like reading all the essays and stuff, but they are like, they really put time and effort into their releases, I think.
Well, and it's just like, you know, they do these really amazing interviews and commentaries and essays, and it's like, it shows how the impact of these movies and like what it means to make them and the love that goes into making them and the impact they've had culturally and on individuals. I think those special features really do speak to the power of the films and really reinforce what they mean to people and what they mean to the horror community. And even if you're not a huge horror fan, like what they have meant to you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I do have one final fun question for you, which I'm asking every podcast guest because it's something I'm quite obsessed about. Because you mentioned earlier that you have a shelf full of Blu-rays, as do I, as does, I imagine, everyone listening to this podcast. And I'm obsessed with how people organize. I don't know if it's just because I love organization, but I'm obsessed with, like, it has to be, you know, in, like, in alphabetical order, although, like, maybe the Bond films would be together, or maybe, like, there'll be a series there. So I want to know how you organize yours, because people have wild methods, like...
I'm chaotic in that I have my own cataloging system in my brain, but on my shelf, it's all organized by labels. So like Vinegar Syndrome, Arrow, Criterion, and then Blu-rays are kept on their own shelf, and then their DVDs. And then within that, I go by genre, like found footage. They all have to be together in case they want to look at found footage. So like, it's a very weird, haphazard way of organizing, but like it works for me. And I also like, I have all of my French New Extremity films together. So it's like by what kind of movie, like,
yeah.
It's like the sub category. Like all my anime is in one section. So label and genre are kind of how I go.
Yeah. I haven't heard that one yet. Last week's guest basically just kept theirs in boxes and just sort of went in to see what they would find. But I'd be like, how would you find a film? That would give me a heart.
That brings me such anxiety, because like I was doing that for a while before I had shelves, and I was like, I hate this. But now they're like all prettily displayed, and all like my special editions are like up out of the shelf on the top of the bookshelf, and then everything else is like has its place. So yeah. That's wild. But yeah, I have my own like weird cataloging system.
I quite like that though. I like it because you could like even though they're all in alphabetical order, sometimes if I'm in a mood for like a comedy, I'll be like, oh no, like what film should I watch? But if you had it by genre, which is how you have it, or like by like, I could be like, I'm in a mood for an anime, I'm in a mood for a horror, and I can just sort of pick from there. It works. I think it works. I like it. Chaotic, but it works.
It's like a record store. You know, they have it all like kind of arranged by genre, and you're like, just go for it. That's kind of what I'm at.
Yeah.
On my shelves.
I love it. It kind of feels old school. Well, thank you so much for joining us today for the podcast.
Of course.
And if people want to see more of your work, follow you on social media, where can they do that?
So you can follow me on Twitter at MB McAndrews. You can see all of my writing. I actually have a second site essay coming up in the like Mungo edition. So if you want to check that out, that'd be great. And also like Mungo rules, and it's really scary. But yeah, MB McAndrews is where to follow me on Twitter, and you can see all my projects. I have a million projects.
You do have a million projects. You're not underestimating that. Well, thanks once again for joining us. It was great. It was great to chat about all things Babadook. And to all the listeners out there, we'd love to hear your thoughts on both the film and the podcast. So please share them with us on our social media pages. Just use the hashtag Video Rewind. On Twitter, we are at Zavi. On Facebook, we are at Zavi Online. And over on Instagram, you can find us at Zavi UK. We also upload our podcast to YouTube in video form, so you can see our faces, talk about movies. And see, we're all like, our backgrounds are pretty, they're looking good today, by the way, I think. I like your
posters. Right? I know. I love, like, I have my new French Extremity poster, my screen poster, all of my pins. You can see Jennifer from Jennifer's Body. And then, of course, my slot. Gotta balance out the horror with a cute slot.
You do. I saw the screen poster. I was like, I love that. And I want it, basically, in my house. It looks so cool.
Paid for, like, $11.
That's insane. Well, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and the platform of your choice so that you never miss an episode. And don't forget to give us a rating and review too. And if there's a film you'd like us to discuss, just let us know on social media, once again using the podcast hashtag Video Rewind. Thanks for listening. This was Zavi's Video Rewind, and I'll see you in the next one.